wide web on KBOO.FM and in that manner to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of How We Got On at the Portland Playhouse, Wednesday through Sundays until October 25th. Directed by Jen Rowe, How We Got On is the story of three teenagers in the suburbs of the Midwest who dream of fame in the golden age of hip-hop in the late 80s. That's How We Got On, Wednesdays through Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. through October 25th at the Portland Playhouse, 602 Northeast Prescott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hip-hoppin' is the thing that's in. It's where the Stone Cold Nitro party begins. So listen, party people, with the ear to the street, the college professor and the social elite, to the fly young guys and the pretty girl, IT is gonna tell you about the hip-hop world. Hip-hoppin' is a way of life.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang with a bit of a head cold, but I think we can carry on. And we are trying to contact our guest is Robert Parry, who is a veteran journalist. He was writing stuff back around the 1980s about the Central American Wars, which got him in a lot of trouble with the powers that be. And he is, for the last 10 years or more, he's been the publisher of a excellent website called Consortium News, which presents his reports and also other writers, and it's a great website to consult, and you can subscribe to it, get daily updates or whatever. It's spelled Consortium, consortiumnews.com. And we're still trying to get Mr. Parry. Our topic is going to be, Russian President Vladimir Putin, who has been kind of a thorn in the side of the empire now for quite a while, actually, ever since he became president of Russia back around 1998 or something like that. He was kind of picked by Boris Yeltsin. And the empire loved Boris Yeltsin because he basically gave away the store. The Soviet economy had collapsed, and there was all these valuable properties and which were theoretically owned by the people of Russia, and but somehow they wound up in the hands of these would-be oligarchs. Now, the oligarchs were people in the kind of in the apparatus of the Soviet apparatus. They were called the nomenklatura, and they were able to control different kinds of operations, mines, and retail places, all sorts of economic valuable properties, and they were able to pass them on to the banks of the West, and a lot of people got very, very rich. But now we have Robert Parry. Robert Parry, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I gave a little introduction while we were waiting, and I was saying that sort of going into the history of why the West is not like Russian President Vladimir Putin. It goes way back to the Yeltsin days, but more recently we've had this kind of strange confrontation at the UN where Putin made this speech, which was pretty well received by a lot of people, apparently not by Washington, and the U.S. kind of, they were very insulting toward him. I mean, they criticized his slouchy posture, and they said he was desperate for a meeting and with President Obama. I mean, this is very strange. And so then, just a couple days after that, all of a sudden, the Russians are bombing ISIS in Syria. So what do we make of all this?
Well, I think it's there's a certain amount of confusion as to how the Obama administration wants to handle a number of problems, and there are divisions within the administration on how to approach this. In a sense, this sort of gift horse of what Putin wants to do in Syria, the Russians, and there was some understanding between Obama and Putin, as I understand it, that the Russian role would be welcome because obviously the U.S. strategy has not worked very well. So on one side, there was this thinking that, well, that Putin could certainly help bolster and broaden this, not just the anti-ISIS coalition, but also the fighting against al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has probably more of a significant role in Syria through its Nusra Front affiliate, and that the need was to take on those extremists and somehow stabilize the political situation so there could be some kind of political transition or negotiation over power sharing in Syria. But then there were elements of the Obama administration, much more hard line against Putin and against the Assad regime, and appears the president let that faction sort of set the tone, which was very hostile, even to the point that the president's press secretary, Josh Earnest, goes out at the briefing a week or so ago and literally makes fun of Putin's appearance, saying that Putin was at a meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel and had his shirt, had his coat unbuttoned, had his legs spread, and you know, if you look at a picture of the two of them, they both had their mm-hmm. coats open and their legs spread. But this was kind of a tone. And then and I must say, President Obama reflected some of that tone in his UN speech. It seemed to have been written largely by the hardliners. So there's this confusion, which we often see in the Obama administration and how it wants to approach some of these touchy international events, where some people welcome the idea that Russia can pick up some of this load in Syria, and some people don't.
Well, I think just this morning on the news, some voices from Washington were saying that, he was supposedly bombing ISIS, but the targets he picked were not ISIS targets. They were, I'm not sure what, moderate anti-Assad rebels or, you know, I get the feeling that apparently they're trying to portray al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda group in Syria, as sort of a little more moderate than ISIS or something like that, isn't it?
Yes, that is happening in some circles. Some of the neoconservatives, for instance, have been, over the past several months, trying to sort of almost present al-Qaeda as a potential ally because Nusra is, at least in a sense, opposed to ISIS. They were together but then split apart. But they're very close in ideology, obviously. Their differences are ISIS wants to have an Islamic State, a caliphate that it starts building right away, and also in killing the Shiites and killing the Christians and killing the others that get in the way. Al-Qaeda's view is, well, we can't do the caliphate right away. We have to engage in terrorist acts against the West, like 9/11. So there are differences, while they're significant, I suppose, among the two groups. As far as the West is concerned, neither is particularly acceptable. But yes, the problem has been that some of these supposed moderate rebel groups, which don't really exist in any real sense in Syria, at least not anymore, they've been absorbed by mostly by Nusra Front. Some of these recently trained U.S. Groups, the CIA and the Defense Department, has been training some of these rebels, the so-called moderates, and when they go in back into Syria, they join up with Nusra or ISIS, or they're taken over, and they give them the U.S. supplied weapons. So we've ended up now with Nusra and other of these very radical groups using American TOW missiles to destroy Syrian tanks as they take over more and more of the country. So there's been this incoherence in the U.S. policy because it is focused on trying to get rid of, have regime change in Syria. But it also wants to sort of deal with some of these extremist groups. So some neocons have been arguing that we should sort of essentially ally ourselves with Al-Qaeda, which was the reason we got into the Middle East mess to begin with. So there is what you might call either an incoherence or a craziness to some of these policy ideas you're hearing from Washington.
Well, you get the impression, I don't know, it's like these guys in Washington, they sort of think that they are smart enough to kind of really meddle in a very thoughtful, careful way. They can kind of promote this group and then get rid of them and then promote another group. I mean, it's really weird that they think they have the wisdom to do this. And it seems to me, just judging from results, they made this colossal mess. Every country they've touched in the Middle East is a mess.
Right. I think there's a lack of realism in Washington. And that's, I guess, that shouldn't surprise a lot of people, mm-hmm. but it's almost reached the point of insanity. If you consider sanity the ability to deal with the real world around you. In Washington, the focus is on what the think tanks are saying and what the editorial boards are thinking, what the meetings at the State Department, what people at it, what they're kind of feeling about each other. It's almost divorced now from the real world of the Middle East. You have a good example was what happened in Libya, which was everyone thought we must get rid of Muammar Gaddafi because he's a threat and he says there are these terrorists he needs to kill and we shouldn't let him do it. So we go in and we destroy the Libyan army. We allow Gaddafi to be captured and tortured and murdered. And then we find out that Gaddafi wasn't really lying when he said there were all these terrorists he was dealing with because they essentially took over the country in large part. They killed the U.S. ambassador in Benghazi and three other diplomatic personnel in Tripoli. The U.S. embassy and other Western embassies have closed down because there's no security. So this idea that you can just sort of go in, get rid of some bad guy, as we like to say, and then have some nirvana follow is just not the case. We saw it, of course, in Iraq, too. But we have these think tanks and these pundits, these are what we call armchair warriors, and things seem to be they work very neatly on the little talking points, and they work, and when they're at a conference, this all seems to make lots of sense. But you can't just apply it to these countries, especially through this kind of violent means that the United States has opted for to do regime change, either through direct intervention of U.S. forces like Iraq or aerial bombing attacks, as we did in Libya, or in Syria, this idea of arming and letting our allies like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey arm these extremist groups to then overthrow a government we don't like, but not understanding that once, if that happens, if right now if Assad is overthrown, the very likely winners are going to be ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
That's right.
And then the United States has to figure out what it's going to do when the black flag of terrorism, Sunni terrorism, is flying over Damascus and ISIS is lining up the Christians and the Alawites and the Shiites for beheading. I mean, what do we do then? So, I mean, there's this sort of failure to sort of anticipate the next problem, as we've seen now again repeatedly over and over and over again.
Well, I think this goes, you know, this goes way back to 1949 when the U.S. overthrew a Syrian ruler named al-Kuwaiti because I think he was too progressive or too close to the Soviet Union. They got rid of him, installed some other crooked general, and he got aced out later on. And then in I think it was 56 or 57, there was a plan to overthrow another Syrian government. And so this has been going on for quite a while. You know, it's like the U.S. has overthrown the sort of the secular progressives or leftists, and that now they're stuck with these jihadis. And it's just, I think this accounts for part of the mess. But isn't there sort of a principle here that, you know, you have a lot of really odious regimes that are recognized sort of on the world stage? And so what gives the U.S. the right to pick and choose? You know, we somehow Assad has got to go, but it's okay that the Saudi rulers behead people on Chop Chop Square in Riyadh and threaten to crucify some kid. I mean, it's getting more bizarre all the time.
No, it's true. There is this selective outrage. I wrote a piece the other day at Consortium News about even the issue of barrel bombs, which has become this big buzz phrase in connection with Syria. But barrel bombs are just like crude bombs. They're kind of clumsily delivered. They're thrown out of helicopters. And I'm not advocating bombs, but the United States has, not only has the United States bombed countries all over the world, literally hundreds of thousands of tons of bombs were dropped on Iraq alone in the last dozen years. The Saudis, who are using American bombs, are bombing the heck out of poor Yemen, this impoverished country. Earlier this week, they blew up a wedding and killed 130 people using American bombs. So, and the Israelis as well. I mean, they bombed the Gaza attacks where they, 2,000 or so people died, including those four little boys on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of bizarre for President Obama to have included in his UN speech. He reads it, this reference to this tyrant using barrel bombs to kill children, when there's been this long history of not only the United States, doing shock and awe and all the rest of it in Iraq, but providing weapons to our quote allies like the Saudis, as you mentioned, who are dropping bombs on innocent people in Yemen. So we seem to be, and what makes a barrel bomb worse than one of these other bombs?
All right.
There seems to be no logic to this, mm-hmm. these distinctions, except that the United States chooses to like the Saudi, dictators. They call them kings there, but dictators. And we don't like, people like Assad or Gaddafi or Hussein or other people. So we do pick and choose, but we then get involved in these things without really understanding where they're headed.
Right.
And what the consequences are likely to be.
Well, when I think of horrible weapons, to me, the number one would be a white phosphorus. I mean, this is stuff that it's like flame that sticks to your skin. You can't wash it off. You can't jump in a pool of water. And it just eats through the skin right down to the bone. I can't think of a more horrible weapon than that. But that's what I believe we were using that in the battle over Fallujah and other places.
Yes, there are horrible weapons that are obviously nuclear weapons which the United States used twice on Japan. You had in Indochina more bombs dropped on that poor part of the world than were dropped in all of World War II. So in those cases, in the case of Indochina, literally millions of people were killed, and many of them were children. So uh-huh. The idea that there's some white hat group and some black hat group is often the work of propagandists, not of people who look at things in any kind of objective or honest way. But as part of the approach that the U.S. government has been taking, and I've sort of followed this, especially since the Reagan years when I was working for the Associated Press. But what we've seen is this idea of using these propaganda techniques, and much of them are put white hats on our guys and put black hats on the guys we don't like, and then we demonize even further the guys with the black hats, and no one dares say, hold it, you know, they're not good, but they're not the worst thing on earth, so no one even dares say that, so everyone just piles on. And these dynamics become very dangerous, especially in a world like this. And we saw what's happened just by having a black hat on Saddam Hussein and insisting he must have those weapons of mass destruction and he must go in. And now we see the chaos that has been unleashed by that one grotesque misjudgment. And that with now not just the Middle East being destabilized, but we're now seeing Europe destabilized with the refugee flows.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
these problems, sometimes you do have to sit back and think things through and understand that the consequences are not neatly controlled. But that has been a huge failure in official Washington.
What?
Everyone takes these tough guy, tough gal positions, and that seems to sell, but the consequences are devastating.
Well, it's easy to do that when you're sitting at a desk in Washington. You know, it's like investors investing with other people's money. I mean, these guys are playing with other people's lives. And, you know, now, you know, they got this concept of strategic communications, which is sort of, that's the updated version. Makes me think of a CIA guy back in the 40s talking about the mighty Wurlitzer. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, sure.
And it seemed like this, well, you call it groupthink, which is what it is. I mean, it's, and now with Putin, you know, sending the Russian Air Force over Syria, you know, are the groupthinkers regrouping, or what are they trying to do now?
Well, I think, again, there is somewhat of a division here, but the predominant view is that Assad still must go, even if that were to risk almost a certainty at this point that ISIS and al-Qaeda would win. And that means that there has to be this anger about Putin because he's intervening at the request of the Syrian government, by the way. This is not like, you know, when the United States has gone in to bomb in Syria, there's been no approval. It's essentially illegal. The Syrian government didn't ask us to come in. They have sovereignty over this space. The UN has not asked us to do it. We've just done it, right? That's how the U.S. operates, I guess. But here's a case where the Syrian government has asked for Russian help to sort of beat back these rebels. But the view in Washington is increasingly that must be stopped. But now the problem now is when this started with the Ukraine mess, which some of the neocons had their fingers in too, another regime change they wanted to do in Ukraine. When you start dealing in demonizing Putin, you're now talking about the danger of thermonuclear war. Because if we get too extreme and too crazy about Russia, and we decide that our position is the only perfect one in Ukraine and theirs is evil, and we start making those kinds of judgments, then you could push this beyond a point where people can control it. There was William Polk, one of the writers for Consortium News. He was actually one of John Kennedy's diplomats during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's now in his 80s. He lives in France, but he writes for us. And he was writing about how the Ukraine situation has the danger of becoming a kind of Cuban Missile Crisis in reverse, in this case where the United States is pushing with NATO and potential nuclear weapons up to the Russian border, and they could freak out. And then the chances of accidental or, those all the different possibilities to starting a nuclear conflict become real. So uh-huh. These things really should be weighed much more carefully than they are. And we see this in Syria, which is, you know, it sounded great, just get rid of Assad and so forth. But then we've now ended up with hundreds of thousands of refugees flooding Europe. These things were not really anticipated by the brilliant guys sitting in their nice offices having conferences and writing their op-ed pages. But this is what happens. And as you say, it does feel very different when you're just playing with other people's money or other people's lives.
What's it like living in Washington with all this going on? And you feel kind of lonely, or is there a small group of people with sense? I mean, what's it like?
Well, it is strange. There's no question. The idea mostly, you know, in the official world. So, and that's where the craziness is most prevalent, I suppose. You can meet nice people all over Washington, and they talk sense. They talk about sports, and like most people do. What I've encountered increasingly in the official world is that people operate with this deeper and deeper groupthink. There's greater and greater fear of being out of step, because then you're called so and so apologist, you're a Saddam apologist, or you're a Putin apologist. You're, you know, so there are all these insults thrown at people, and what that does is it marginalizes them, and people don't like to be marginalized, because it means they have fewer chances to get a promotion or keep their job and so forth. So, I think what you've seen is a kind of enforced groupthink in many cases. We certainly saw that in 2002 when if you didn't agree that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, you were some kind of a lunatic. You had to be discredited and destroyed and silenced,
mm-hmm.
And that happened. And even people like even the Dixie Chicks, when they criticized Bush's plan to invade, they were people threatening to kill them. So that was the tone and the mood, and it hasn't changed. The biggest problem that followed the Iraq War, in my view, at least as far as Washington was concerned, is that there was no accountability, or virtually no accountability. Most of the people who promoted that war remain very respectable parts of this official Washington. The journalists, the media people who were totally on board, lost all objectivity, all professionalism. They're still there. They're still running the news organizations. You know, Wolf Blitzer is still there. Michael Gordon of the New York Times is still writing pieces about today about Syria, much like he did about Iraq back in 2002. So with no way to sort of make a correction, this momentum of essentially neocon liberal hawk dominance, especially in foreign policy areas, has just continued.
Well, you know, back in the day, I.F. Stone would never go to press conferences or official meetings. He just sort of spent his time reading records and all sorts of things. I mean,
right.
And so tell us about Consortium News.
Well, Consortium News, because I came out of the mainstream press, I was with AP and Newsweek and PBS, but by the mid-90s, it had become clear to me that the kind of work that I had been doing, the Iran-Contra scandal, the Contra drug trafficking problems, things of that sort, were no longer welcome in the mainstream media. As an investigative journalist, I could maybe cover people's sex lives, but they really didn't interest me. Or I could deal with some of these silly non-scandals about the Clintons and their financial shenanigans back in Arkansas. But the big issues, the ones that really relate to the national security of the United States, were almost off limits. So at that point, I was collecting a lot of very important documents that no one seemed to want, some of them highly classified. So we started the website. My oldest son Sam, who just got out of college, said, "You know, instead of complaining, Dad, why don't you just start a website?" And I didn't know what a website was. I should tell you, back then it was just sort of a new concept. So we started Consortium News, and so we publish sort of serious, kind of, in a sense, old-fashioned journalism. We often challenge the conventional wisdom. We challenge the groupthink. And as part of this, although we set up this operation to try to provide a home for investigative reporters, what has also happened is that we've ended up with a number of old CIA analysts who want to write for us, some former old diplomats, like I mentioned William Polk, a very smart, brilliant guy, knows a great deal about the Middle East.
I have to admire his articles. I've been reading them, yes.
Right. So anyways, that's what we've been doing.
Well, I think I really want, I would like our listeners to check it out. I mean, this is a very valuable resource. And these days when groupthink seems to rule or hog the airwaves and everything, we need these voices of reality. So I want to thank Robert Perry. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we'll keep abreast of all that's going on. I don't know. It doesn't look like it's going to get any better, but we will have to see. So thank you for listening, and stay tuned for KBOO, your radio station.
Yes, it's KBOO Portland, your community radio station. A couple minutes in front of 10 o'clock on this Thursday morning. In 15 minutes, we'll kick off Flashpoints for 45 minutes, and today features a powerful new speech given this week in Berkeley by journalist, activist, and political analyst Phyllis Bennis. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman speaks with legendary local writer Ursula K. Le Guin about the new edition of her book, Steering the Craft, a 21st Century Guide to Sailing the Sea of Story. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is Robin Cost Lewis. Her new collection of poems is called Voyage of the Sable Venus. First, though, it's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Chris Andre is coming up next on KBOO. And thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support in our recent membership drive. You can still contribute by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is seeking an individual or group to contract with to help build our next 3-year strategic plan. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shares knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. We have been serving the Portland community since 1968 and are one of the oldest independent community radio stations in the country. The person or group who is selected will co-lead the development of a strategic plan with the KBOO Strategic Planning Support Work Group, made up of volunteers, board members, and staff. More details about the application process can be found at kboo.fm/planrfp2015.